And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Ussery, and I'm happy to welcome Barry Wolverton back to the program today. Barry is an author of middle grade novels. His first was Neversink, then he followed up with the Chronicles of the Black Tulip series. The first installment of the trilogy was The Vanishing Island, followed by The Dragon's Gate. And today we'll talk about the final entry, The Sea of the Dead, which is published by Walden Pond Press. Now, Barry, how long has it been in the story since our hero Bryn Owen has left his home in Mat Britannia?
It's been about a year and a half.
That's a lot of formative years to be spent on the road having these very daring, if not outright dangerous, adventures.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he's 12 years old when he leaves home. I think there's sort of a joke in the third book about where he's sort of lost track of how old he might be. Yeah, those are very formative years. That's, you know, one of the reasons I like writing for this age group, because a lot happens between ages 12 and 13, 13, 14. And he does a lot of growing up before the end of the series, or by the end of the series.
And he's even worried about the condition of his skin at one point in the story.
Yeah, he, you know, mirrors were not a big thing in the 16th century, even in an alternate 16th century. And so he probably goes more than a year without ever seeing what he looks like or how he's transformed himself. And, you know, it's kind of a shock to him. And, yeah, he decides he needs to do something about it, which gets him into trouble. As most things he does, gets him into trouble.
And it was nice to see a boy character who's concerned about his looks for a change.
You know, absolutely, yeah. We're vain too, aren't we?
And, of course, he had to have, like, the most expensive treatment for that possible.
Yeah, of course. Sort of a paste made of roe.
Caviar.
Sturgeon. I had salmon on the brain, but sturgeon roe, which is caviar.
Now, to remind the listeners, the world in the Chronicles of the Black Tulip is very much like our own, but not quite.
Not quite.
So what is the beginning of the early 1600s like in Bryn's world?
Well, as you said, it's very much like ours, or like it was for the real 16th century. You know, it's the age of seafaring, or the age of discovery, as Europeans called it. Except in my world, the reigning country is the Netherlands. I've always had a fascination with the Netherlands for some reason. So the Dutch, their shipping company, so the Dutch East India Company, it's the Dutch Bicycle and Tulip Company. And England, or Britannia, as it's called in my series, is kind of more of an up-and-coming challenger to the Empire of the Netherlands. And also, there's a little bit of magic in this world, which is one reason I wanted to set it in an alternate seafaring age. And I sort of, I'm always been fascinated by sort of the borderlands between fantasy, reality, magic, science, religion, all that sort of thing. So that's one of the things that makes this world a little bit different.
And as we make our way through the series, we find out it's more of remnants of magic past.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. You know, they're pretty much across all cultures. There are sort of mythology or folklore about, you know, once upon a time, these ancients or these magicians or these gods ruled the world. And so now why is there seemingly no magic in our world? And there's always some sort of interesting folklore or storytelling about, you know, how magic disappeared from the world. And it's kind of interesting, you know, I love reading fantasy, but sometimes I wonder, I sometimes feel like authors sort of just conveniently say, well, these powerful magicians want to rule the world and no more. Well, you know, why not? You know, what's so special about regular humans that, you know, that magic would have disappeared? So,
because we can ruin anything.
We can ruin anything. You know, so I've always been a fan of Ursula Le Guin and sort of the rules she sets for her fantasy and the rules for magic. And, you know, it's not just some Latinate phrase or a talisman that gives you power. Magic is really something quite difficult and dangerous and double-edged. And so I tried to make sort of a plausible explanation about why magic would be sort of a thing of the past that, you know, had been abused and lost.
Did you have a rule set when you began the series, or did that evolve over time?
It sort of evolved over time. Probably, you know, I'm not going to say I was as rigorous as Ursula Le Guin in establishing the rules for my book. But it did sort of evolve over time, but it was something I tried to keep consistent through the three books.
Now, Bryn has been all over the Eastern Hemisphere. Mm-hmm. Did you have his path in mind at the very beginning on where he would go? Or would you go from place to place and go, oh, where would be a good place to go from here?
I had that in mind from the get-go because, you know, if you remember the mouse character from the first two books, I definitely always wanted him to go through China, through the Far East, because for one thing, their storytelling, mythology, history has always been very appealing to me. I mean, I didn't want to just use it as a prop in the books. You know, the whole thing is Bryn, you know, he sets out on this voyage of discovery at age 12, and with this set of beliefs and thinking he knows what he wants and knows what he believes about the world. And so I kind of wanted him to literally travel through the world to become disabused of that. But yes, I kind of had this circuitous journey in mind from the get-go.
And is it a desire of yours to kind of interest people in older legends and folktales? Because it seems like our mythologies of past have been supplanted by Star Wars and superhero movies.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, first of all, anybody who loves superhero movies and Star Wars, I think should understand something, you know, the patterning stories that gave life to, you know, even, you know, modern mythology like that. And, you know, I've just always been interested in the parallels. And when you look at mythology and folktales from around the world, you know, there are these foundational similarities, right? These patterning stories, whether it's creation, life and death, how the, you know, the sun rises and sets. But there are some very different poetical differences in the way those stories are told and related. And, you know, I was kind of struck when I started researching Eastern mythology more, just, you know, how beautiful and haunting it is compared to some of the more prosaic Greek and Norse mythology, which I also love. But even if you just look at the names of some of the folk tales and the legends and even the books, the ancient texts, it's just so lyrical. I found that captivating.
Is there a particular story from one of the traditions that stands out to you?
No, nothing in particular. I wouldn't say that. It's just the body of work. You know, I have that passage in the second book where Bryn is with the Alzu and the rest of the crew walking through the forest above the clouds. And everywhere he's been in China, there's been some lyrical story about why this is named that, or, you know, why this is called this. Or, and he asks Yaozu, well, what's the story of these giant pillars rising from the earth? And Yaozu says, well, why don't you make one up here on, you know, on the spot? And Bryn does. I don't know. It's so evocative. I've never been to China, but I would love to go because it just seems like the most evocative place on earth.
And in the first book, Bryn lives in little seaside town of Map, mm-hmm. known for making maps. Mm-hmm. Rand McNally is based there. Mm-hmm. And he wants nothing more to see the bigger world and go to the lands where these legends and tales originate from. But coming into book three, The Sea of the Dead, he is ready to go home.
He is ready to go home. You know, that's pretty much a classic trope in kids' adventure, right? They want excitement and adventure, and they get more than they bargain for. Yeah, Bryn, you know, in book one, he's, you know, the way I always describe it is, you know, his father wants him to follow in his footsteps and draw maps. Bryn wants to be the one to discover these new worlds so men like his father can put them on the map. But, you know, as you suggested in your first question, he's been through a lot for a 12-year-old or a 13-year-old in a year and a half, and he would love nothing more than to get back to some of the normalcy he was trying to escape and map.
He might even be happy to see the old bully.
He might even be happy to see Duke Swars.
Now, the book doesn't open up with Bryn or his father, David Owen. We open up with the Minister of Wit in Kashmir in the Indian subcontinent area, what mm-hmm. we think of. But we really don't get to meet this minister, do we?
No, not for long. All the books have opened with a prologue that seemingly has nothing to do with the main characters of the main story. Of course, they do. But yes, for this one, I wanted to introduce two main characters by way of this prologue, this strange setting. You're not quite sure where you are or why you're there. And yes, this minister is, you want me to give it away? Sure. He's going to meet a member of British intelligence because Britannia has been trying to work with the Mughal Empire on an alliance of sorts, which is explained a little bit more in the book. So he goes off to meet this gentleman who he thinks will help him foil what's called the Lapwing Conspiracy. Emperor Akbar, the Mughal emperor, has these 9 ministers who are of key importance to him, and one of them is sort of the governor of Kashmir. And there's been a threat. There's been all these poems left around by this mysterious woman known only as the Nightingale. He's obviously worried about it. And without giving too much away, it turns out trouble is a lot closer to home than he thought.
Can you give us kind of a quick overview in this world of the Mughals, the Mongols, the mm-hmm. Kashmiris, and how that whole geopolitical thing is going on in mm-hmm. the subcontinent?
Sure. And again, this is sort of loosely based on what happened in our real history, but fudged a little bit. So Akbar and the Mughal emperors and the Mughals are... Or do I call them the Moguls? I think I call them the Moguls.
Yeah.
I sort of like using the sort of archaic spellings in the book, Moguls, Muslims. Yes, they are currently controlling a great part of India, northern India, central India, and that area. And they want to expand their empire. Britannia is trying to increase their political weight in the world versus the Netherlands by partnering with Akbar to help them gain control of the rest of the Indian subcontinent in return for gaining more of a foothold in that Far Eastern shipping that the Dutch Bicycle and Tulip Company controls. And, Kashmir, which, one time was an independent kingdom, has been folded into this, but there are people there who don't want to be folded into it. And that's one of the main characters who Bryn comes across in the book, is someone who would like to reassert the sovereignty of Kashmir versus Akbar.
Now, the Ministry of Wit. How did you come up with that idea?
I don't know. Akbar really did have 9 ministers called the Navaratnas, his 9 jewels. But there is one of whom there's no historical record. And I thought, well, there's the perfect one to just have made up. And so the name Maladopiazza, that was a real name from the history books, except there's really no record that he actually existed. So,
did you ever see the French movie Ridicule? Ridicule? It's about 20 years ago. It's Patrice Lecomte. One of the coins of the realm at court was your wit.
Mm-hmm.
If you could be as mean and sarcastic as possible, you had a place at the table.
Yeah.
And so this guy comes from the countryside, and he's trying to get drainage ditches to keep mosquitoes out of his kind of swampy area.
Mm-hmm.
And so he has to become this really mean-spirited, biting guy at the dinner table. And it's a very interesting movie. It's for grown-ups. So.
Yeah. That sounds great. Yeah, wit. I love that word for some reason. For one,
Brevity.
Yeah, it's brevity. It's very layered also. Of course, it has a lot to do with intelligence also, not just trenchant sarcasm. So, I don't know. I love words like that.
And you have a couple of new comedic characters. In the past, we relied on David Owen and Archibald Black. But now we have a pair of twin bodyguards.
Adesh and Adarsh are the bodyguards of one of the new characters, Shweta. She is the woman who believes that she is the rightful queen of a sovereign Kashmir and believes that there is some lost magic to reclaim that would make it possible for her to claim the throne. And yes, she has these bodyguards who are huge, menacing, fierce. They have these huge swords. But as you come to spend more time with them, you learn they have a little bit of a humorous side to them. One's a chess expert. They get into some sort of funny verbal sparring matches with Archibald Black in particular as they travel together from Kashmir further into the Middle East.
Is there any particular meaning behind their names?
No. I did some cursory research on Indian names or Kashmiri names, whatever would seem appropriate. And when I came across that, I thought, that would be funny. Kind of like these, almost... Frickin' frack. Exactly.
Now, also at the beginning of the book, you introduce another secretive cabal. And that's the League of Blood.
The League of Blood, yes. This is also based loosely on some folklore about the a group of men who supposedly possess all the secret knowledge of the world, and no one quite knows how they're chosen or how they're succeeded. So that was very interesting to me. It sort of fit with some of the other mysteries Brand had encountered in his journeys. And so, yes, the League of Blood, which is not quite what it sounds, but is quite dangerous.
Now, at the beginning, Bryn and Sean, who is his older companion and mostly protector, are on their own. The traveling party has been pared way down. Mm-hmm. They're not traveling with Mouse anymore.
No. Hopefully, all of you've read The Dragon's Gate, and so I'm not giving away too much of the ending to say the Mouse is no longer with them. And Sean and Bryn are trying to get home by going west, following the Black Jade River through the mountains of Central Asia. But they suddenly discover they're being pursued, and they don't know why. And it turns out Bryn left the Himalayas with... Kunlun Mountains with something very valuable that he didn't know was on his person.
Yeah, he picked up a pretty rough nickname.
yeah, he did. You want to tell it?
The Thief of Knowledge.
The Thief of Knowledge, right. I thought that was pretty cool. I mean, it's just, there are worse things to be called. But
Bryn would never think of himself as such.
He would never think of himself as such. And at this point in the story, the last thing he wants is to be pursued by something called the League of Blood for something he doesn't know he has and doesn't want.
Also, at the beginning of the story, we don't even know where Lady Barret is.
That's right. She also disappeared at the end of book two through the Dragon's Gate, or so Bryn and Sean thought. But she's pretty indomitable, and you might not be surprised to find out that she does make a comeback.
Now, in the Dragon's Gate, Bryn's father, David, who he's always had a kind of a distant relationship with Bryn, is worried about his son having set off at the age 12 on a Dutch sailing ship to go around the world, essentially, decides to go find his son. And he and Bryn's most favorite adult in Map, Archibald Black, set off in South Asia under the guise of a survey trip. Mm-hmm. Where do they find themselves at the beginning of the Sea of the Dead?
Yes, they have set off. This was all part of that political alliance I mentioned, under the guise of being part of Britannia, helping Akbar and the Mughals survey India for military purposes, which was one of the original purposes of detailed mapping. They have found themselves in India, but they have found themselves not where they want to be. And in book two, they realize they were had sort of been captured by Akbar's army and taken in a direction they didn't want to go. But an earthquake caused by Bryn opening the Dragon's Gate hundreds of miles away allowed them to escape. And they have found themselves in Kashmir, which David Owen, with his map-making knowledge, thinks is a neutral territory in this region, or a disputed territory, I should say. But they find out that, Akbar doesn't think it's disputed at all. He thinks it belongs to the Mughals, which is part of the conflict with the new character, Shweta. So they find themselves in Kashmir looking for a way out. They're not very optimistic that they're going to find Bryn, and they also just want to get home safely.
But they pretty much go from frying pan to fire.
Yes, they do, because it turns out in Kashmir, they depend on, there's a Christian minister there who they think is going to secret them out of the country. Instead, he secrets them into the hands of Shweta and Adesh and Adarsh. And they, I won't say pretend to think, but they accuse Archibald and David of being spies for Akbar. And they both think they're on the verge of not making it out of Kashmir alive. Instead, they strike a deal to help Shweta in one of her plans to make it back to Persia, which is sort of an intermediate stop where they want to go. They think if they can make it back to Persia, they can make it home. And Shuaitha wants to go to Persia because she thinks she can make an alliance with Christians there to help retake Kashmir from the Mughals, because the Christians also are against the expansion of a Muslim empire. Sounds very convoluted for a children's book, but I'm telling you, it works.
Also, why was Archibald Black carrying around a huge custom copy of the Gutenberg Bible?
Why not? He carried it from home originally as... why did he take it with him originally? I've written so many books now.
A little light reading.
Yeah, a little light reading. That was going to be his... when they originally snuck into India under the guise of doing a survey, their goal was to make it to Persia, the House of Wisdom, where they had sent Lady Barrett to find clues to where Bryn might have gone or might have been taken. And, you know, you can't just walk into the House of Wisdom in Baghdad. So he was going to bargain his way in with this one of the most valuable books. I mean, a book that would be coveted by people who are in charge of something called the House of Wisdom. So that's why he has the Gutenberg Bible, and he's legging it around.
Now, Queen Shuaitha, is it?
Shuaitha, yeah.
Shuaitha has a young girl who accompanies her in most places. Her name is Ani, and she is not what she appears to be.
She's not what she appears to be either. She's a young woman about Bryn's age. She has these mysterious green eyes, irises, but the white, what would be the white of her eyes are green. Bryn has a penchant for befriending young people who have strange abilities or strange backgrounds. And Ani, in a way, takes the place of Mouse as this companion.
But she's a little bit more high octane than Mouse.
A little bit more high octane, and yes. But also, like Mouse, a little bit. This is one of the things Bryn has trouble with on his journey. One of the things he's just disabused of is that adults are trustworthy. I mean, that's pretty common in children's books. But also, when these people he tries to become friends with, Lady Barrett, Mouse, Ani, you know, they sometimes prove unreliable because it turns out they all have their own agendas, and you know, they're not necessarily just there to help Bryn fulfill his dreams.
A whole lot of cross purposes going
yes,
on there.
Absolutely.
Now, how did the Queen come to use the term bub?
I knew a highly educated man like you would call me on stuff like that.
I was just wondering.
I just thought it was funny, and it just seemed like something Shuaitha would say. I've never shied away from anachronisms. I remember when I started on the Chronicles of the Black Tulip series, I was thinking, okay, it's set in an imaginary 16th century, and you get the Dutch and the British and all this good stuff. You know, how historical should the language be, the dress, all that kind of stuff. And what rescued me from the perils of unintentional comedy was hearing an interview with David Mitchell, one of my favorite authors, and he was... he was Cloud Atlas, but he was being interviewed about The Thousand Autumns of Jacob de Zoet, which is a historical fiction set in Japan in the 18th century. And he was talking about that, and he used the term bygoneese. You know, basically, he didn't feel like he had to exactly use language that might have been used only in the 18th century. But you wanted to feel historical, but, you know, it's okay to bring a little contemporary into the mix. And another of my favorite writers who does this too is Hilary Mantel, who's written the Wolf Hall series, which is fantastic. She does the same thing. I mean, she's setting this book. It's told in the first person, and it's set in the time of, you know, Henry VIII. But it feels both historical and contemporary at the same time. So that was a very long explanation for why I used the word bub.
I was just wondering why bub instead of buddy or pal or sport.
I just like the word bub. Just sounds more abrupt. It just seems like, you know, Shuaitha doesn't have patience with this tall, skinny, balding man back talking her. It just, you know, just felt, it felt right.
It just makes me think of what's the hubbub.
Yeah.
Now, we don't want to give too much of the story away, but I will say in reading the second half of the story, a name came to mind, and that was Hampton Sides.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And I've read that book, In the Kingdom of Ice, and saw him speak. I already had a fascination with the North Pole when that book came out. And, you know, my fascination with old maps, which helped drive the first book and the series in general. And like this idea that, you know, before people had ever been to the North Pole, there were all sorts of interesting and fanciful theories about what exactly was up there. And one of them was that there was a warm, open polar sea, or basically a paradise at the top of the world. And there were some very valid sounding scientific explanations for why that could be. and so, yeah, when Hampton Sides came here with his book In the Kingdom of Ice, and I read that book, it inspired me. I was like, I really want to have this series finish at the top of the world. It just made sense to me. And also, it also tied in neatly. I don't remember if I told you when we talked about book one that one of the inspirations for Bren was Jules Verne, who tried to run away from home at age 12, was caught, punished severely, and he vowed never to travel again except in his imagination. So that, to me, that was sort of the model for Bren. And you know, my favorite Jules Verne book is To the Center of the Earth. So yeah, I like the idea of that, going into this icy wilderness and seeing what you find.
What's the engineer's name?
Nindemann.
Nindemann. Yeah, because I was thinking along those lines, and then I went, that name seems very familiar. Mm-hmm. So I went back and looked at the crew list for the Jeannette.
Yeah, I just stole that right from there. Was that wrong?
No, I just thought it was interesting because yeah. Wow, I picked up on something. Yay,
yes.
Me.
Yes. Yeah, Nindemann. I took that right from there. I liked the name. I liked the character.
Do you have another project on the?
I do. I have several ideas, and my agent in particular likes one very, very much, and it's also the one I'm most excited about. It's very different from this.
Still from middle grade?
I think it will still be from middle grade. It would jinx it to talk about it, but if a middle grade picture book sound makes any sort of sense to you, I feel like it's sort of a picture book, but for an older audience.
So in between picture book and graphic novel?
Yeah, I think that might be the way to describe it.
Thanks so much for stopping by, Barry. It's been a pleasure again.
I appreciate it.
The Sea of the Dead is the final installment of the Chronicles of the Black Tulip trilogy, written by Barry Wolverton. I'm Stephen Usry, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is produced by Stephen Usry and is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752. You can find information on upcoming tapings and broadcasts of Book Talk, as well as download podcasts at our blog, WIPLFMBookTalk.blogspot.com.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Number one, you must attribute the work to WYPL Radio of Memphis, Tennessee. Number two, you may not use this work for commercial purposes. And number three, no derivative works are allowed. You may not transform, alter, or build upon this work. For any reuse or distribution of this work, you must make clear to others the license terms of the work. Any of the previous conditions can be waived if you get permission from WYPL Radio. And nothing in this license impairs or restricts WYPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.